Hello, I'm John Bryan.
Amazing.
I don't have to say anything else. Oh. I can go, yeah, I'm John Bryan. I'm not in a band.
Yeah, exactly. well, I don't know. I got something queued up. I went to Wikipedia last night, and I need to read you
One
something.
One should probably never do that in general.
But for humor.
Oh, for sheer bad humor.
This is what yours says. This biographical article needs additional citations for verification. Please help by adding reliable sources. Contentious material about living persons that is unsourced or poorly sourced must be removed immediately, especially if potentially libelous or harmful.
And on that note...
So we have an overall goal for this interview, and that is to
Are you looking to affect the Wikipedia page?
I want some reliable sources.
Oh, well then...
Did you really write the words, "I am John Bryan and I'm a musician," on a piece of paper at age 5?
I don't know if that was the age, but yeah, that happened. You know those things you have in
school
at a very early age? I think my mother may have.
Does your mother?
With great pride.
Yeah, exactly. Except that then she calls you up and says, "So exactly what happened?"
Yeah, exactly. She calls up, "What are you teaching my son?
What are you doing?" You know? So, did you know, by the way, speaking of old bands, that you can buy Pop Gun as a bonus track on Amazon for 99 cents?
I did not know that, but that's really lovely, because that's a really good song. And I can say that without any trace of ego. I love that. I wasn't involved in that whatsoever. Look, this is a great song by a guy named Bill Murphy in Connecticut.
Right.
Just genius song.
Do you want to play it?
Yeah.
Let's clear something up. because as I was mentioning to you off camera, off camera, behind the scenes, backstage, you had it's all over the internet that's like your record. That was like
your debut record. Oh, that's fantastic. No, Bill Murphy was a very talented guy who had come into New Haven, was doing some engineering work within the punk music scene that was going on there in the late 70s. He wrote that, masterminded the whole thing, did pretty much everything on it except playing some of the instruments on the basic track, which I know it's Mark Mulcahy, who later ended up fronting Miracle Legion, playing drums, and and the fellow from Peru Boot playing bass. But Bill mostly did the whole thing himself. It was like Craig Bell.
Okay, so we've cleared history out. So
yeah, I met Bill because, you know, I heard that and thought it was great. And he was working out of a studio that a fellow had in his parents' basement, a guy named John Russell. And I ended up hanging out with Bill and in turn with John. I eventually ended up working at his studio. That was sort of the first place I ever got to mess around. And eventually he got his own building. And God, how old was I? 16 or 17, I think, at the time. But I have absolutely nothing to do with that record. I was on a record about a year later that Bill and I made in the same studio, but I don't think any of it has the same vitality that single has. That single just has something great about it.
New Jersey was the original, right? Mm-hmm. And then you found your way to Boston, and that's where Q Division and all these things mm-hmm. come in. What was in the water back then?
Who knows? I mean, I just think the fact that, you know, it is the college town of all college towns, that there are so many there, and that there's even a music college there, that, you know, as much derision as is aimed at Berkeley, you know, most of the people I know, there are a lot of them who are very good musicians who are Berkeley dropouts who feel like they got X amount and left before they got full indoctrination. I can tell you the reason I moved there was I was living in New Haven and I wanted to move to a bigger city, but by the late 80s, New York wasn't the New York of yore anymore. And I really felt like whatever it was made it magical in the 20s and 60s and 70s, that wasn't there. And the people I knew who moved there tended to be moving there for the myth of what it had been. If they were a jazz musician, it was this notion of what it was in the 50s. You know, if they were an artist, it's what it was in the 60s, and so on and so forth. And it really wasn't that anymore. New York in the late 80s just wasn't particularly fun. It wasn't particularly vibrant, except for the fact that it was a bigger city than other cities. So by, pure critical mass, things could happen there. Yeah, and I would visit Boston, and there seemed to be a lot of musicians there. And I started visiting a lot when they were building the first Q Division studios. I had a friend in Connecticut who said, hey, I've got friends in Boston making a place and it could be pretty interesting. You should come up and visit. And we all got on really well. And while I was there, you know, I'd go out and see bands. And at the time, the summer I moved there, for instance, Treater Wright were just coming up. So it was beginning of Fort Apache and they were in a warehouse. They hadn't had their proper studio yet. For those of you who hadn't heard Treater Wright, God, what was their single that was actually doing well locally at the time? I Think She Likes Me.
Right.
Which was a great record. And the front man was Mark Sandman, who later formed Morphine. So, you know, they were kind of incredible and had this weird chess blues thing, but in a weird post-punk kind of way. It was something very different. And so you'd see things like that and realize that there was a confluence of people and ideas there and some sense of both the history of music and an amount of ability. I had never been around so many people who were proficient at doing their own thing, and that was very intoxicating to me. And even being around the early years of Q Division, there were a lot of people just sort of swirling around who were in the midst of finding their own voice. And that also, that just very, very intoxicating. And I just loved it. And you know, it was a really, really valuable time in my life, but that was the attraction. And I've got to imagine other people basically had the same experience, either coming from smaller towns or they went to college there, and in the course of meeting these different people who were intellectually curious, and you know, it turned out one of your intellectually curious friends also played well. You know, when you look at the history of, well, rock music alone out of Boston,
it's pretty incredible.
It's phenomenal. I remember when Radiohead first came out, and I was already living in LA, and there was a very famous early MTV interview with Tom York and somebody else, and he just is practically incoherent and you know, monosyllabic answers, and they're like, well, you know, well, what do you like? And he's just like, oh, you know, we're mainly just into the Boston scene.
That's a great quote. Of Montreal, ironically enough, is what brought us together. And I interviewed Kevin. He really put his life into the music versus just making an indie rock record. And I would imagine that that's one of the things that appealed to you when you heard the band, is because the last thing I'm sure that you want to do is mix yet another, you know, an indie rock record, because the world doesn't need one of those, you know?
Well, I mean, this may sound really reactionary, but the last thing I want to do is make any kind of record or even have any involvement in any kind of record at all. In and of itself, that doesn't hold attraction anymore. I've gotten to do it so many times that there's no novelty in just proving to myself I can do it, which, you know, when you haven't done that many, there's an absolute drive to see if you can figure out the parameters of just plain being able to do it in a way that doesn't disgust you, you know, when you hear the sound back. And, you know, it was a totally different thing with them. I was... Well, just like being up here, I've created a life for myself where I don't have to tour, where I don't have to even make records. I sort of do enough different stuff when we were talking off camera about having a diverse life.
Right.
It keeps it interesting and fun that sometimes I'm in a subservient role, sometimes I get to be king of the castle, sometimes I'm just a team player and just a guy shaking a tambourine in the back of the room, and I love that. I love that I'm working in a visual medium one second and, you know, a complete esoteric audio medium the next. So that's really a preamble to say that when somebody calls with something interesting or seems like it will be fun or it just seems like a nice idea, it's easy to say yes. So one of the things was... When Nickel Creek were still together, I know all those guys, and I'm friends with them. And they said, hey, we're doing, you know, sort of a final tour, and we're asking friends to come out and play with us for little chunks. And would you do one? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And in the process of that, Chris Thiele, who is just an astonishing musician, you know, we'd all... actually get on the bus after the gigs and play for 2 hours, you know, and it would happen naturally, you know, somebody would go, oh, do you know this song? And no, and instead of reaching for their iPod, they'd grab a mandolin and they'd play the first, you know, 4 chords, and somebody else would hear the chord and go, wait, that's great. What's the voice? And grab their instrument. Within 15 minutes, you have a rolling, tumbling thing. But on this one particular evening, driving down a highway in the Midwest somewhere, Thiele mentioned to me, he's like, oh, have you heard of Montreal? And I'm like, no. He's like, and he got that thing that, I mean, I can remember everything about it physically. You know when you see true absorptive excitement on another human being. I mean, absolutely, suddenly a friend realized another friend was missing this component in their life. And before he even put it on, to see him be like that, is really something, and he has ears for days. And he put this thing on, and he was sitting on the couch on the bus, bouncing up and down, chair dancing in his seat, mouthing every single word, pointing at the speaker at every nuance of counterpoint. And I recognized this. It was rather shocking because I was watching him do something I'd done to other people on certain occasions of my life. Like, no, you got, wait, this bit, oh, wait, are you here? Ah, isn't that great? And it was happening song after song, and I realized even watching him that he had been living in this record for months. The level of detail he knew about was quite incredible.
Wow.
And it was the Hissing Fauna record. And we had a number of funny moments. And I'm like, okay. And I looked at him and said, this is really good. And the song that starts with talking about, you know, being on the verge of a nervous breakdown while living in Norway, and he felt the darkness of the black metal bands, and, you know, and Thelia's singing along quasi-operatic to the thing. And I just looked at Chris and said, you know, he's not kidding. And he stopped being animated and almost went white and looked at me. He's like, well, do you know this guy's story? I was like, no, you're telling me about this now, but I'm telling you, he's not kidding. And he proceeded to go, well, he had this breakup and this, and then he went there. And I'm like, no, I can tell. And a little bit of time went by, and I'd sort of even forgotten exactly what the name was, and called him a few months later. It's like, okay, wait, what was that thing we were listening to that was just sensational? And he told me, and I got the record, and I think about 2 weeks later, I just started singing details of it onto his answering machine, and we became quite the mutual appreciation society. I absolutely stewed in that record for months, and it was the first time since, I don't know, discovering Elliot Smith or something, where I really honestly lived in the record. So this is all a very big preamble to say, how did it happen? Actually, I can tell you how it happened, because it's literally what led me to this room. So Chris was coming through L.A. and played on a show of mine, and we basically played a whole chunk of my show unplanned, just two acoustic instruments, and started doing crazy high-energy rock covers and dancing around the stage in this hall that I'm playing in at the Coronet in L.A., and it has nice acoustics for playing without a mic. So we were going at it, and we started talking about of Montreal and how we were crazy about them, and we started playing as many songs from that record as we could remember without rehearsing. It was very funny. And later, I was in the middle of producing something, months later, and Ashley Arison, who works with me, got an email from a publicist for Of Montreal saying, yeah, heard you were a big fan. We have their new record. Do you want a copy of it? It's a few months before it came out, and it was like, send back an email saying yes, and if there's ever anything they want, just don't be afraid to ask. I'll do anything, any way, shape, or form. So got a copy of the new record, loved it, and they asked for some remixes, so I made a few. I was delighted to see that they liked them enough to put out all the variations. I was actually told they were putting a record together of remixes by various people, and I, in my excitement, did multiple versions of each song. I even called Chris Thiele, who I can't remember if he got on a plane or if he happened to be in town. I said, hey, I've got the new Of Montreal records right here. You can come listen. I'm doing remixes. Want to play on one? And that's hence how we did our
wow
acoustic version of the thing. And then, you know, I was delighted that they put it out as its own set of things. I was just sending some things so Kevin could pick his favorite one. And then the reason I'm here is they asked if I'd come play a show, and even though I don't tour, and the only reason I think it's worth getting into all this detail is it's a very nice example of how things can happen if you just allow things to happen. In other words, I have not been somebody who's... I've had plenty of opportunities if strictly what I wanted was power, money, fame, more people to know my name, whatever, that kind of crap. All you have to do is do things repeatedly in situations where people will see you do the thing you want to be seen as repeatedly. And, you know, if you're competent, you're pretty much there. That's all it takes. I'm not really particularly interested in that. Like, I don't mind doing interviews, but I sure as hell hate those days where, you know, you do 8 in a row of the same questions.
Yeah, the promo thing. Yeah, forget
and
that nonsense.
Repeat the same anecdotes. And,
right.
And I was tired of that as a music fan. You know, you know, somebody's new record would come out, and then across, you know, they're in 8 magazines with the same anecdotes, and you're just like, ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
This, you know, and now we get to meet and have this conversation, and I'll, you know, get to wander around town
and
up
it's
here,
fun.
And it's great fun. It's a preferable life. And, you know, I got to touch on the thing you brought up earlier, which is in the notion of stuff being popular or unpopular. To me, I've never been interested in specifically making what would be called pop music or what would be called underground music. Neither one as a camp has anything of interest to me, and no real fun. I've done things that could lean more to one side than the other if you've got to categorize what type of music it is, but my attraction is always based on something about the stuff at hand, and the decisions made about the thing at hand are made with, you know, very little reference to what's specifically going on in the top 40 or what's specifically considered cool. So it's sort of tough, because I think if you just look at the language, it's like, oh, well, you're trying to be reactionary. It's like, no, I want to make music that's enjoyable to listen to, but that's the criteria, and that alone is not an easily effective route of world domination.